The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2013 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2013. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the internet. To find out more about ACCS, or to order additional conference talks, visit our website at accsedu.org. Look for the Conferences tab. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Craig Dirksen, and I'm the head of the School of Rhetoric and Fine Arts at Regent School of Austin. And I don't know if it was a psychological test to see which teachers would come on a Friday afternoon at 3:10 to talk about grading. But whether you pass the test or in fact it actually shows other concerns, here you are. Thank you all for being here. This is not one of those exciting topics often, and when we think about why am I teaching? What is it that I want to accomplish? What am I attracted to by this role? Grading doesn't make the list very high. Often we actually completely forget to put it on the list of things that we need to do. What I want to kind of suggest is that we think differently about grading, and instead of seeing it as this add-on, that we actually consider it as an integral part of what we are doing in our roles and functions as teachers and as classical Christian teachers. I'm going to throw a lot out, and hopefully I'm going to do it in enough time that we can have some discussion and Q&A. This is entirely a thought process in process, as we've been trying to think about it at Regents and work through this stuff, and I look forward to you all helping to contribute with that. So in my mind, there's really two different ways to look at this whole thing of grading. There's the what I'm calling the via negativa way, the negative way, and then there's the opposite one that I'm actually going to propose. And this one is essentially this, and this was my view when I first came to teaching. It's grading is a product of this fallen, broken world. It's a product, it seems like, of modern education wanting to quantify all that is good, true, and beautiful and say, it's a 36, or it's a A-. And so we can be tempted to say, no, we are going to reject that. And in our rejection of that, then, we are going to see if we could create some sort of grade-free academic utopia, where there is just learning, there's no grades. When we interact with students, it's just about the substance of the classes we have, and we don't have to worry about the grades. And when we give the grades, since we have to give them, since most of us probably don't work in a grade-free school, that our conversations with the students can be, well, don't worry about the grade, I thought you did a good job. Utopia, as we know from Sir Thomas More, is nowhere. We are tempted to think that way, but to take that approach does not, I can speak with experience, it doesn't work well. Having a conversation with parents about their child's grades and saying, no, the grades don't matter. It's actually, our mission is to nurture a love of what is true, good, and beautiful in your child. They're still going to be concerned about the grades. We can have these ideals, but we live down here on earth. In our case, in Austin, Texas, and our students are having to take a high school diploma and take that into the world. And so it can seem like, well, are we kind of capitulating then to make grades a part of it? Are you saying, really, just accept the compromise? And I kind of am. But what I want us to do is think about this, not just in, well, if everyone has to do it, then we'll do it, and we're just going to fumble along, but instead to do what I think Jesus actually would want us to do. When he sends out his disciples, and actually from what we just heard, I want you to consider the directive that he is giving his disciples. Behold, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Now to a Hebrew audience, serpents have a particular reputation and connotation. And when he is directing them to not be naive, he does want their moral innocence, but he does not want them to be naive about how the world is going to interact and perceive them. He doesn't want out of that naivete for them to actually misrepresent the gospel and the good news. We need to be shrewd. We need to be cunning. We need to be thoughtful and wise in how we take this spiritual mission, an academic mission, our partnership with the parents in this, that seems to correlate with public education or whatever the other elements are in our culture, and say, we're going to use the same things, but we're going to use it towards our mission. When we do that, that actually is a way that we can be participating in the redemption of what people even think about when they think of education, what they even think about when they think about the role of grades in our journey with our students and with our families. So I have what I'm calling the via affirmativa. We're going to affirm the fallenness and brokenness of each of us, of our students, of ourselves as teachers and educators, and of the world that is having to look at us and say, what do we think of what's happening between 8 and 3, Monday through Friday there? Okay, so now the question is, well, what is it about, which part of the sinfulness and brokenness is relevant to this mission of education? And so let me kind of touch on a few points with each of these groups, and I'll start with the students. In many ways, this may seem the most obvious. Grades are a motivator, because in their brokenness and in their sinfulness, they are not just going to do everything we ask them to do out of obedience. Right? Can you imagine if you said, no, the reason you need to do your homework, the reason you need to participate in class is because it would be disobedient not to. That doesn't work. Right? Because they are broken. They have their own conflicted desires and motivations. And it may be Halo, or it may be sleeping, or it may be a number of different things, working out for football if they're in Texas. It'll be a lot of different things that are competing for their motivations, but that brokenness, the fact that we give grades, there is both a carrot and a stick that's involved with that, that is a response to the fact that they may know what they ought to do, but that doesn't mean that they will or can do that without understanding that there is this other element to it, and grades gives us that other element. We have students who fear failure. If we understood our identity in Christ, they would not fear failing. But in being broken and not accepting that, they may not venture out and try to do their best, or even in a discussion to open their mouths, unless they know I'm getting graded on this. I have to overcome this fear because I'm getting graded on this. I have to work through this. And then just our own self-awareness. We do not have eyes to see ourselves accurately, what we know, what we don't know, what we contribute, what we don't contribute, how smart we are or how not smart we are. We don't see that accurately, and it isn't just a matter of having the mental faculty to be able to do that. It's hard to see how much you don't measure up. It's hard to see that you're not as perfect as you would like to be, right? We all see ourselves with rose-colored glasses. We can use grading as a part of having seen ourselves the way that we ought to and taking accurate assessments of what we know and what we don't know and how we've engaged with things. Okay, teachers. Guess what? The list is pretty similar with the students. Our motivation, our ability to assess, right? It can be really fun to be in class, and my first year teaching, I was teaching in North Carolina, at a classical school, and I was stepping in a little bit as the school was in process. We jumped in with the reconstruction, and I had a blast. We were cranking through. We were covering all sorts of material. We just, it naturally blended, and they started to see connections between that and the Gilded Age and the industrialization. We were just running along until finally sweet little Michael raises his hand and says, Mr. Dirksen, it's been 7 weeks since you started. Are you ever going to test us on any of this? We were having fun. I was having fun. People like Michael are actually learning a lot and feeling the burden of, when am I going to have to demonstrate this? There were other students in the back row that were thinking, this is awesome. He just kind of keeps going, and he seems to be having a lot of fun, and so do Michael and a few other people, and I can just kind of sit back here and not worry about things. Because their eyes got large as saucers as soon as they heard, uh-oh, maybe he is actually going to test in that. It holds us accountable to make sure they're learning, to not just give them enjoyable activities and have an educational process taking place that doesn't then may or may not result in learning, may or not actually result in what it is we're trying to do. And so having to give grades gives us that. Having to give grades also helps in our own lack of self-awareness. I may think that I am a brilliant teacher, but when I give my children a test and I see how much they didn't learn from what I thought I had covered, okay, that's hard to hear. And I can have students tell me, you confuse me, or I'm not quite sure what's happening in this class. But until I actually ask them, do your best on this to show me what you've learned, and a lot of them aren't unable to give back to me what I think that I have explained and taught them, it is a tool for me in my own growth of how do I actually accomplish what it is that I am trying to accomplish. So it's a tool in my own brokenness where I may not want to see that. Grading, giving assessments that are graded are going to give me that feedback and that tool. The world. And there's really two parts of this. I'm going to include our parents in this because they're not sitting in the classrooms. And we'll say colleges and scholarship and anyone else that's having to decide, what do I think of your diploma? We cannot assume that people will accept our honesty when we say, this is a good school that is preparing your child or this student for the world. Right? I can't get on the phone to Rice University and say, I have this kid, Kate Stotesbury, and I've been looking at university, and she's been spending the last 4 years with us, and she's perfect. Will you take her? Right? Why would they trust me? Well, if we weren't broken and fallen, I would never say that unless it was true. But because that isn't the case, instead, I have to produce a transcript. I have to take what sweet Kate has been going through for the last 4 years and have some sort of summary that says to wherever she might want to go, this is what she's accomplished. And in this light, you then have to decide, I think she's a great fit, I'm going to write a recommendation, but this is the proof that you should trust me when I say you should take her. We usually don't think about that when we're teaching individually. But what it is that we are doing, for it to translate outside of our school, it's because we are actually being able to successfully do that. And grades are one of the things that are going to help us do that. Parents, it's the same thing. There is an extreme culture of anxiety around post-high school decisions and options and opportunities. I'm sure we all feel it and watch our parents go through it. Our families are generally unreflexively happy and supportive of what is happening at Regents and the fact that we grade difficulty and that we have a rigorous program until freshman report card. Because then all of a sudden, they're now thinking, how is this going to translate? Who is going to trust that this school knows what they're doing? Well, how do I trust that the school knows what they're doing? Wait a minute. Let's talk about these grades. What do they mean? How are they done? And so how we grade as a whole and as individuals is part of what they're going to have to sift through and understand. And we can either ignore the fact that that's a legitimate question. We go, well, we know that we're doing the right thing. Or we can say, given that you have reason to distrust because people are dishonest in the world, that I'm the dishonest and you're dishonest, and that we have competing interests and desires on all of these things rather than having all of our priorities and our trust in God, Since we don't have all of that, grading is part of the journey and the translation of what we do to parents and everyone else outside of our school. Okay, so let me break it down to then three simple goals. Regarding parents and others, our grading should be something that convinces them of the value of our education. And I use the word value very specifically because it is a value proposition, what we are offering. And for the parents, the value isn't just the same thing that it is for colleges, right? Colleges have an academic lens that narrows it. For our parents, it's much wider, but grading can actually contribute to both being convinced of that. For our students, it's to focus them towards the good. Notice it doesn't say focus them towards learning a lot. Our mission is not just curricular, and to focus them towards the good means that they have a good and truthful understanding of themselves, that they have a good and truthful understanding of what it means to measure up and sometimes to not measure up, to know in concrete ways the consequences of the hard work that they do and the consequences of not doing hard work. Our grades can be a part of them understanding that whole thing as well as learning math. And for our teachers, it's the same thing. The way that we grade should guide us towards the good in how we relate to students. When we are grading students, and we have some who are getting A pluses all the time, and we have others that are getting C minuses all the time, do we love them the same? We should. And the fact that they get those different grades will actually reveal that and actually will test us, and they will know. And for the student who struggles to figure out what's happening in your class, for him to know that that has absolutely no bearing on how much you love him, that will direct him towards the good. And that will be for you even a process of directing you towards the good, because we ought to love without preference. Okay, so I'm going to give five principles. I'm going to describe these in a little bit better than these somewhat cryptic little sentences, and then spend a little bit of time with each one of them. That'll be the bulk of our time this afternoon. It's not personal. This is what I mean by that. Grades come from the school. They do not come from an individual teacher. That transcript at the end of your child's high school education does not have anybody's name on there except the school's and the registrar, who is the representative of the school. Number two, equal is as equal does. The value of every grade should correspond directly to the time required to earn it. The grade is the is, the work is the does. Okay, number three, there are different kinds of assessments. This is process, not product. There are different kinds of assessments. We should treat each according to its function. We'll talk about the different kinds that we have here in a second. Number four, grade what you ought. Also rhymes with taught. Only expect students to know what you have taught them. And number five, and this is actually a very important one. This is where mission and practicality come together significantly. Subjectivity is not the same thing as relativity. Grading is an inherently subjective activity, even when we are assessing the learning of objective content. Okay, we'll take a little bit of time to unpack that. Okay, so let's go to it's not personal. This little cacophony of lines. These are five different potential distributions of grades in a particular class. You can see an inflated curve that's mostly here on the far right, in which pretty much everybody gets an A and a B, and besides a B, there's nothing. So that is an inflated grade. You see the opposite of that, the deflated grade, where pretty much everyone's getting an F, a C, and then it pretty much drops off and you have a couple people that get A's. In all of our schools, we always have a few kids that get A's because we could sit them on a rock and they would still learn it. That's why all of these curves are always going to have people that get A's. We don't get credit for those. We just need to not mess them up. The third one is a compact bell curve. And essentially this is the difference between your top students and your bottom students is very small. It's like somehow all of your grades just get into one little spot, and there really isn't a big difference in the way that you're grading between your top and your low students. An inverted curve, and that's the one that kind of looks like a smiley face kind of dropping off there, is when you have students getting A's and you have students getting C's and there's a wasteland in between. And there's a number of different reasons why that might be the case, but it's a very odd curve. And then you have the last one that's right there in the middle. It looks like a little mountain. It's just a classic bell curve. Most of your students are in the middle, and then you have some students, a few students that are not as strong, and you have a few students who are stronger. Okay, why did I put all five of these up here? If this were representative of five different classes, let's say, of your sophomores, it would likely mean that you as a school are not aligned in what an A is, what a B is, and what a C is. And if this were the pattern year after year, colleges would look at your transcript and say, I have no idea. I don't know if these students are strong or not, because sometimes they get A's, but sometimes they don't, and his math grades go from, he had a 95 his freshman year, he had an 80 his sophomore year, he went back up to a 90 his junior year, and then he got a 95. I don't know how to explain this. Hard for the student to say, well, the sophomore teacher just, he didn't give any A's, right? That would raise those questions. It is important that we give grades not as individuals, but as a school. And so what we talk about at Regents, we can use the science word or the music word, is calibration or tuning. And really what that means is, and there's two different directions of calibration and tuning. There's horizontal and there's vertical. There's the freshman class experience and there's the math sequence from when I go from a freshman to a senior. And there should be a consistency of deciding what does it take to get an A, what level of mastery is an A, what level of mastery is a B, what level of mastery is a C, what does not pass. It sounds burdensome. It can maybe even sound to the cynical like grade fixing. It is not. What it is accepting that when I am grading, I have to decide, what is it going to take to get an A? What is it going to take to get a B? And those are relative grades. Why we came up with A, B, C, and sometimes D and F, and what those actually mean. What does it mean to be exemplary? What does it mean to be average? What does it mean to be above average? All of those things, we have to figure out what that is. And left to our own, that's what it looks like. And we may talk all the time together as teachers with one another, but honestly, we barely look at our own grade books. We're certainly not looking at one another's. And so we may think, well, certainly we're calibrated. Certainly we're tuned to the same understanding and level of rigor. But the reality is, unless we talk, we aren't. And so the action from this is to tune together. We need to talk. We need to share. We need to compare grades. And we need to get to a place of agreement. And your school may have a, we've already talked about this, and this is what it should be. And so your talking is, I need to get tuned to the tuning fork. Or it may be that we actually need to get together and make sure, all right, where are we with this? At Regents, one of the things that looks like is at the beginning of the year, a first set of themes come out, large homework essays. And teachers will sit around a Harkness table at lunch with their lunches, and they will grade. And they will have a number, and they'll pass it around, and then it'll work its way around and say, okay, Catherine, what do you think? Well, I was thinking a 92. Really? I had 88. You can know, split infinitives all over the place. And they'll work through that and get calibrated on, okay, Catherine's a 90. And they'll do that not with every single one, but enough where they are learning okay, what when we say what a certain level is, what does that translate to when I look at an individual test? It does take time, and it may sound burdensome. Let me tell you that as we have become more calibrated together, what I have seen with the teachers, they have confidence when they give a grade that that's the grade that it should be, and that there will be consensus if someone questions it, and that it will be consistent. If I'm a sophomore history teacher and I give grades, I know it's consistent with the kind of freshman grades they got because we've had these conversations. And no one's going to be surprised. The parents and the students start to feel like there's a lot of consistency here. There's a predictability here. And predictability in a learning environment, and there's been a lot of research on this, is an incredibly supportive thing for students. Students actually will get more motivated if there's a predictability about the environment. If you've got a teacher that is known as deflating grades and jacking it and is harder than anyone else, that demotivates students to actually be able to do their best. So you're not holding the line, you're actually hurting your students. And so it does take work, but as you do that, it frees yourself and it gives you confidence as you're giving assessments that you are giving, in our case, the Regents assessment of what a sophomore theme grade is. Okay, so the next slide is equal is as equal does. I have a nice little picture of a map with monsters. And I want to talk about projects for a second, because with projects, here there be monsters. I'm not a fan of projects. Because of this principle that the amount of time that goes into it should correspond to the grade that is earned, with projects, that is often not the case. With projects, they often invite much more time than they will actually benefit for the grade that they get in it. And it might not be that you actually require that time, but the very nature of the project is this group collaborative thing where you need to get together on your weekend, you guys need to work this out, you need to put together a skit, or you need to put together a board or a PowerPoint or all these different things. Those take a lot of time. And if your school's like mine, your students don't have a lot because they've got seven classes that are all throwing fastballs. And if we do a project that is wasteful of their time relative to the grade they're going to earn, we do our students a disservice. 5 years ago at Regents, I killed every single project, including some that were absolutely beloved. And teachers had to reapply to do a project, and I gave them criteria, this being one of them, the time that you require and limit needs to correspond to the grade. And most of them came back and said, you know what, it's not worth it. Now that I look at it, I would rather that they would be learning Spanish or reading Moby Dick than doing this assignment. So I caution you with projects. The two projects that I love are lab reports and themes. Right? Those are big projects where it's not just daily work and they're having to spend a lot of time and they're academic and they're structured and they're focused and they've been hammered out on those details and they do not require more time of the students than the worth of the project. Okay, the next is process is not product, that each kind of graded assessment should function consistently with the type. There's really two. I kind of have the last two is actually one split into two different kinds. But really, there's mid learning and end of learning. The mid-unit assessment is an assessment where you really are, for yourself and for the student, you're just trying to get feedback. Okay, so this might be a homework assignment. This might be a quiz. This might be board work that you're having students solve problems on the board. The value of this is I know what I know, or my student knows what he knows, and I know that he knows or doesn't know what he's supposed to know, and so I can adjust my teaching accordingly, because he's still in the process of learning that in the unit. Okay, value. I believe that the value of those should be small. The reason they're small is they don't need to know it yet. They're still learning it. And so if you make the value of that too big, homework would be a classic example. If the value of your homework ends up being too big, students may pass your class and they never pass a test because you've given them all of it. They're doing homework, by golly. They're not learning anything, but they're doing homework and they're checking in, but they're not actually learning it on the ability to take a test later on it. And so their grades end up being inflated because you're not assessing their what they've learned. You just assessed, were they participating in the learning process? Okay, the turnaround on that needs to be fast. Since they are in the process of learning, you better get back to them at how well you did on a quiz or how well you solved that problem so that they can make adjustments and learn. And so if you're giving quizzes and because of the routine or the workflow that you have, it takes you a week or 2 weeks to get them back, you probably shouldn't give those quizzes. You should adjust how you're giving quizzes so that you can give that feedback. And it might be that you have students grade each other's quizzes, and then all you have to do is verify those. There's a number of different little tricks you can do. But if you're going to give mid-unit assessments, your primary goal with that is that this is valuable feedback for the students so that they can be learning. I'm going to hit, if you notice there, it talks about a target. Once I hit all three of those, I'm going to talk about that subject so you understand that one. End of unit assessment. Okay, this is different now. Now, I've taught the reconstruction, and I'm now given a test to see how much of it have you learned. I'm now saying, we're going to go deep on this whole thing, and you're going to demonstrate to me what did you learn about the reconstruction. It should have a high value, because this, after all, is academically what you're expecting. You're expecting that they learn about the reconstruction. Now I'm going to see the big chunk of your grade is going to be how much did you learn. The turnaround on this doesn't have to be as fast. You're going to go on to the Gilded Age next, and so it isn't necessary that you get that back in 24 hours. Our turnaround for tests is a week. Test themes is to get those things back in a week, and that's a consistent expectation. Okay, semester a year exam is like the unit exam, except there's one difference, is that now it's not about depth, it's about breadth. You've done all of those units all semester long. We do semester long exams. I know some schools do year long. Our spring ones just cover the second semester. This is, again, a question of mastery. What did you learn this semester? But now it's a question of breadth. It shouldn't be at the same level of detail that you gave each of your units, because they are not going to have memorized over the course of the semester that amount of information on each of those units that they're able to reproduce in December. It is a breadth question, and so the kind of questions and the kinds of answers that you're expecting should be different. So now I want to talk about that target question. When I say target, I think about it in the context of, if this is the right answer, what earns me credit and points? Do I have to hit the bullseye? I'm a little sloppy, but it's a little bit bigger. Or what if I'm at least in the right vicinity? I'll give an example. Our sophomore rhetoric class, at the beginning of the year, our students have to memorize Aristotle's and Quintilian's definition of rhetoric. When they take a quiz, they have to have it word for word, punctuation for punctuation, correct. And if they don't, they get a zero. Now, it's a mid-unit assessment. The ultimate value of that quiz is really small. But the reality is that we want them to know this is the definition, and you're going to try and get that correct to be able to go forward. When they see the definition of rhetoric, according to Aristotle, his is a little longer than Quintilian's. Quintilian's nice and short. They don't have to have it comma correct. They just need to have every single element of his definition of rhetoric in their test. Because that's what I wanted them to know even when it came to the quiz. And here's the principle I want you to think about. We should always practice. Practice should always be harder than the game. For those of you that have played sports, I played basketball. Good practices absolutely exhausted you. And the expectations were far higher. I'd have to shoot 90% free throws at the end of practice. I never shot 90% in a game. And coach knew I wasn't going to shoot 90% in the game, but until I would shot 90% in practice, I wasn't done shooting free throws. The bar is higher in practice so that when it comes to game time, I'm over-prepared for the game. And so in our immediate feedback and understanding a concept, if we can be giving them, no, this is what it is. This is the proper understanding of this topic. This is exactly what happened. Knowing they're not going to be able to do that with every little thing that they learn over the course of the semester and year, but in their tests, a couple things are going to happen. When they go into tests, they are going to get used to the confidence of, we've had a good set of practices, I'm ready for this thing. And then they won't walk out of the test feeling like, wow, okay, we've had all of these little math problems on this level of complexity, and then I got to the test, and there were 7 different kinds of things required for one question, and I'd never had something that difficult before. They should have had perhaps even more difficult things than you are actually trying to get them to accomplish by the end, so that they are over-prepared as they're going into those major assessments. Okay, number 4, measure what you taught. This is a nice little house in Canterbury that's rather crooked. Cabinet makers have a tendency when they are there are gaps and issues in their workmanship to blame the sheetrock guys. Well, the walls weren't really straight. That's kind of their fault. I'm just, you know, this is what it is. The sheetrock guys, of course, say, well, it's the framers. I mean, we did the best we could. Man, you should have seen what it should have been like, except I did a great job. Of course, the framers are saying the foundation on this thing was a joke. So you have to excuse the fact that this building's crooked because it really was their fault. And of course, the foundation guys are saying, well, the guys that graded before this, they didn't give us something flat to work with, so it is what it is. We have a tendency with our students to be shocked that they didn't learn something from the other guy. And to be, oh my gosh, there are problems in that 8th grade math class. I'm telling you, these kids do not know how to work these kinds of problems, or these kids don't know how to write. And so their grades are low because they didn't learn it before. Sorry, these September grades are horrible, but this isn't my fault. This is his fault. We take the students where we get them, and we start teaching them from that moment. And so if they have gaps, don't kind of have that cavalier, look, it's not my fault, it was the guy before me that they don't know these things. Take the time to teach them. And if that means 1 year, your freshman physics class starts here, and the next year you realize, wait a minute, I need to start back here because they don't know the unit conversions and they're supposed to. All right, that's your task. That's what you take on. We only grade them on what we taught. When it comes to content, I think we classical schools have a tendency to make this mistake where we're just alarmed that the students don't know their colonial history because they had the whole colonial thing in the 5th grade. And I don't understand how my seniors don't get this. It's like, what are they teaching around here? For us to remember that it's not like we have this, wow, we have this perfect 13-year vertical alignment. And so, man, they get the Native Americans in the 3rd grade. We really don't have to spend much time on this, do we? No, we have to, at whatever point, know that I'm kind of starting here at ground zero, and I'm going to figure out, and we're going to piece together, and they're going to go, oh my gosh, I can't remember. Yeah, we did this in the 8th grade with Mr. Williams. That's great. And then you can pull that in. But assume that they don't know anything that you haven't taught them, besides, obviously, a general set of basics. Let me say another thing with this, and it has to do with reading quizzes. Us literature teachers, in particular, can have the temptation to try and catch them if they're not doing their reading, or if, heaven forbid, they're reading it on SparkNotes. And so if that's the case, we're even trying to catch them of, oh, you wouldn't know this if you read SparkNotes, because there's this part of the book that SparkNotes doesn't address. My experience with that, one, it violates this, because we're not teaching them what we taught them. Instead, we're playing cop. My experience is that it always catches the wrong kids. Your good students, your earnest students who are trying to learn, aren't trying to be able to pass those kinds of quizzes. They're trying to learn. And so they get dinged where they didn't make that connection on Huck Finn. But because they didn't, they're losing points. But they should not be that low, because that actually isn't reflective of them in the learning process. And so with reading, those kinds of mid-unit assessments that are low in value and that we're working through, assume they're doing their homework. Assume that a lot of times they don't. But take the long view. If you are, there's a couple sides of that. One, it'll catch up. If it doesn't, they're brilliant. And like I said, those are the ones that get A's if we set them on a rock. It will catch up, and that becomes part of their learning journey. And what we want at the end is to produce wise students that know themselves and understand themselves. And so if they get caught on a unit test, not really to be able to say anything about Moby Dick because they didn't read any of it, it'll come out and they'll learn that the next time. I've had a number of times when I've had students not reading a particular book or reading spark notes on a particular book, and they fall further and further behind in the discussions until the book gets really good. And then all of a sudden, their motivation shifts to, I'm missing out on something. I want to read that. And they'll try and work their way back in and pull themselves back in. And that's what we want. We want them to love the journey. And if along the way they make some poor decisions about what they do or don't do, we have confidence that big picture, it's going to work itself out. We're going to be able to come alongside them in that journey and help them figure that out without having to be a cop. And that's the other thing, is that y'all want to be teachers and not cops. And teaching is far more fulfilling than trying to play gotcha with kids and trying to catch them and hold them accountable along the way in that journey in ways other than just, this is the learning process. Last thing I want to say with this, with Measure What You Taught, we have something at Regents that we call post-test corrections. A post-test correction is, I've given a test, I've taken them back, I've graded them, I've discovered that in the process of measuring what I taught, there are some things on that test that I should not have been on that test because that test has revealed I didn't teach it to them. And so a post-test correction is me saying, okay, this test was out of 100, but there's 16 points here that, except for my kids, the rock learners, no one got it right. Or they demonstrated I confused a lot of them, or there was something wrong. And so I have to take those off the test. If I have a teacher and I get to December and I say, how many post-test corrections did you have this semester? And they tell me zero, I will challenge them about how well they're self-evaluating their own tests and how accurately they're testing. Because we are broken, fallen people, and we need that feedback. And almost always, not every test, but certainly over the course of all the tests and all the classes I give in a particular semester, the reality is I should be making some adjustments and corrections because those tests are going to reveal to me some gaps in my own instruction. I've had a set of tests that I actually threw the whole thing away and apologized to my students. It was an essay test, and I had completely unprepared them for the prompt. And I just had to admit it. I just had to say, y'all, this is embarrassing, but I cannot give you all grades on that test because the grades that you would have earned on that test are horrible, and it's my fault, not yours. And so I had to go back there because I had tested them on something that I had not taught them. Okay, number 5. We often confuse the terms subjective and relative. Relative is there's really no bottom line. Subjective means that it is a matter of discernment, that it is a matter of decision, and that is what we are wanting our students to develop, because this is the world that God has given us, and this is the reality, is that it's not, what was the hard times, grad grime, it's not all about facts, facts, facts. It is about accurately understanding and making assessments and judgments about the worth, the accuracy, the value of any particular thing. When we reduce grading, and so, well, grading, what grading really is it is coming up with an objective answer to what you have learned. We're undermining our mission about what it means to actually be human, and that we cannot say there is no flat, simple, unsubjective aspect to the learning, and it's all just black and white. It's not just all numbers 0 to 100. Elements of grading include deciding the complexity of the questions that you ask, the level of precision you are expecting on their answers, the time that you give them to give those answers, and the breadth of the content that you cover. There are probably more. Whether you're teaching math or you're teaching Moby Dick, That is true. And so a lot of times for the hard sciences, the subjectivity comes into the writing of the test. It comes into your decisions about how much am I going to cover in this amount of time? How long am I going to give them to assess that? What am I going to give for partial credit? You have to make those decisions. It's not black and white. And so when we say, oh, look, grades don't lie, this is what it is, we're abdicating our judgment, and we're actually pretending that we're not making that judgment when you've made all those decisions and judgments all along, and it was not black and white at any point. You had to make those decisions. We want our students and our families to know this is what the rest of life is. I have to make judgments about what is the good thing to do and what is not the good thing to do. I have to make judgments on how truthful someone is when they are talking to me and how not. I have to make judgments on how much did someone support what they are saying, and therefore should I believe their argument? Or how much do I say, I don't think there's enough support there for that to actually be something that I should consider? All of those things we want them to do. We're doing that all the time as well when we are teaching. Obviously, that brings us back to that first one, which is the school has to have a unified voice when we say this is what a particular grade is. All that decision, if we're all making those different decisions, we are not functioning as a single faculty, as a single school in those definitions and those discernments and those value decisions. And so that's why we have to have those conversations. Okay, so here's the question then. How do we know what the right grade is? How do we know what to give for any particular amount? Most of us function on a 100-point scale. Most of us also report that 100-point scale and translate it to a 4-point scale, where you may have an honors level. This is the Regents grade scale. You may have an honors that some classes can earn 5 points, or you know, it can get more complicated quickly. And so you have something that looks like this. This is a very important thing. Most of us do not think about this when we are grading. We're thinking, well, that's someone else's translation point. All that matters here is what percentage of the information did they learn, and then I'm going to write that down, and that's it. The problem with that is those decisions can actually lead us to ending up giving a student a grade that may not actually be consistent with what they've learned. It may not correspond directly with what they ought to have learned. So in this case, let me just hit a couple translation points. So an A on our scale is what on the 100-point scale? It's a 95, right? It's kind of right somewhere. The A minus A, A plus, right in the middle of A is a 95. Okay, so a B is a 85. And then a C is a 75. What's an F? If I'm going to say that here's the number that should be attached to, I'm just going to say you failed this. Is it 0? Is it 65? How many of us function with it's just 0? When I say I give a kid a 0, it's a 0. A lot of us do that. Let me give you a hypothetical to show how that translates when we go to the scale. So I got a little kid, Johnny. Johnny is pretty low performer at what comes to discussion. He'll contribute a little bit, but he really just wants to make sure that he doesn't fail, because he knows if he doesn't say anything, he fails. And so consistently, for the sake of simplicity, 10 weeks in a row, 75, 75, 75, 75. So his discussion grade average is a 75. What happens to Johnny if on week 11, or assignment 11, however you want to say that, he doesn't open his mouth? He's mad at his mom for some random thing, or his girlfriend broke on him, whatever it is, and he's just sitting there stewing, and he does nothing. And so if a student does nothing, I can't give him a passing grade for participation because he didn't participate, and so I'm going to give him an F. If I give him a 0, I just send him over the cliff, because that 0 averages with all of those 75s and takes him down 7 points to a 68. And really, a 69.9 is a 0. As soon as I drop down there, I've just hit zero land. If I had given him a 65, it dropped his average 1 point, which actually makes more sense. Okay, the reason that I point this out is that I think it's helpful for us to not think about the grades that we give as this pure percentage from 0 to 100%, and that's what matters. Because the reality is we're giving grades A, B, C, plus or minus, some of y'all have D, or F, and that is actually what matters because it's going to translate. And if you think about it, discussion would be a perfect example of that anyways. When I said that Johnny was getting C's in his discussion, was he really discussing at a 75% level? No, that's an arbitrary number that I've chosen because really I need to give him a C. And what is a C on a 100-point scale? It's a 75. So when we think about our grading, we can get lulled into thinking, look, it's just a percentage. And actually, when it comes to the hard sciences, we can actually really get lulled into that. Well, I'm just going to figure out what percentage he got, and that's the grade that he earned. But thinking back to the subjective decisions that you went into to calibrate that test so that, in fact, truly 90% correct and up should be an A, or 80% to 89% should be a B, that takes a lot of work. And if we're cavalier about that, we may end up giving kids higher or lower grades than they ought to earn when we think about what does an A mean in this subject, what does a B mean in this subject. Okay, so Johnny went splat. So I'm going to talk about the 100. And I want to talk about it in two different ways. One is that I recommend that people grade everything on a 100-point scale as opposed to less. And let me give the 5-point quiz as an example. If I give a 5-point quiz, let's go past the splat, I have a 5, a 4, a 3, a 2, a 1, or a 0. In terms of letter grade, that means I can give an A+, a B-, or descending levels of F. Okay, that doesn't make sense. Why would I give a quiz in which the only options I can give them are a perfect, a B-, almost a C, and then three different levels of Fs? I had a teacher that was giving three-point participation grades in math. It's like, I don't want to make participation a big deal in geometry, and so I'm just going to do 3 points. And I said, wait a minute. Well, you're a math teacher. You should know this. You're giving them 100, an F, 67, or a real F. He's like, yeah, but it's just participation. I was like, no. Those numbers are all going and translating to his overall average on those levels. And so if instead we say, no, I give A's, B's, and C's, and for the sake of averages and numbers, that means that works on that 100-point scale because otherwise our grade books would get really weird, do that. But function with I'm giving A's, B's, and C's on that in the concept of the 100-point scale, whether it's participation grades, whether it's short little quizzes or whatever, so that those numbers actually translate the way that they're supposed to translate. Okay, so the other thing about 100. And this one can get a little tricky, but I think this is really important. Perfection is rare. It's rare. How accurately is that reflected in our grade books, given the number of hundreds that students earn? Okay, if you're like me, you've got a lot more hundreds out there than you do have perfect students. Sorry, you should have gone to that one. It should be rare. Here's what I've watched our students and parents struggle with, and this is a theological struggle, it's a spiritual struggle, is the need to be perfect. And to watch a student in angst over a 98 shows me that we are doing them a disservice when we're giving them any sort of illusion that they're perfect. My experience in grad school in Ireland crushed me on this regard. The first paper that I turned in, I got a 68 on it. And I was absolutely devastated because I thought it was really good. So I went to Margaret Callaher. I was like, Margaret, can you give me some feedback on this? I was like, ah, it's an excellent paper. What are you thinking? I was like, no. Did I not read your numbers correctly? It's a 68. She was like, ah, that's brilliant. I said, help me out. She's like, ah, you're one of them perfect Americans. You think you're so close to 100. She goes, the reality is, because you have this little 90-point scale, you were probably expecting a 92 or a 93. She goes, that's the second highest grade in the class. She said, but you're nowhere close to perfect. So get that out of your head. She goes, this is second class honors. She goes, first class honors is a 70. You were really close on that, which was really good for your first paper. And she just went on and on. And it, for me, it was just kind of real of, and she just had this, like, you Americans, you think you're perfect. And I realized, yeah, we have this inflated sense of that we're close to perfection, that we should be striving for perfection. And I think we as classical Christian schools actually encourage that in really unhealthy ways. And so my argument against 100 is to make it rare. And that has to be done as a whole body. You have to be careful to make sure that it doesn't lead to a compact distribution of grades because you make A's rare. I'm not talking about making A's rare. I'm talking about making 100 rare. I'm talking about making perfection a rare thing. I gave 100 on one of my rhetoric tests this year. And this girl, Kaylee, just, it was this beautiful test. And when I gave it back, she just goes, oh my gosh. And they're like, what? She's like, I got 100. They all cheered. They were elated. They're like, I don't think anyone's gotten that. No one's gotten 100 in this class. I think someone got 100 in Mr. Simmons' history class. I mean, they were like, this doesn't happen. They had, that we're slowly teaching them, you ain't perfect. And when it happens, celebrate it. When something that excellent. And so for us, we have to break kids from that burden of perfection that leads to, honestly, depression, eating disorders, anxiety, all sorts of just unhealthy understandings of self and goals and motivations. To say, no, we have the freedom to pursue excellence, and we'll recognize excellence, but perfection, don't bother, because we're so far from that. And that the way that we grade, the way that we trot off 100s or not, feeds into that. Okay, I'm going to go a little different because I'm taking a little bit more time than I expected. Rubrics. Your rubrics should be flexible. Don't paint yourself into a corner. Make them qualitative in descriptions. Here's what an A will earn. Here's what a B. Here's what a C. Instead of, you get 5 points if you do this, you get 3 points if you do this, you get 7 points if you do this. If you do that, you paint yourself in the corner that you do with a 5-point quiz, which is, I'm either going to give 100 or an 80 on their grammar. Because I can't do anything else with that. Rather than say, an A has, grammatically it has this, content it has this, analysis this, argument, I mean, you can break that down. Allow it to give you the freedom to be able to do that. And then make sure that your rubrics are objective-based. And when I say objective-based, I mean course objective-based. If you are giving them an assignment where you're needing them to do, and this is where projects can come in, this is the reason why I have a stick figure, where that you're going to be able to put together a Spanish or Latin children's book, don't give them points for their art, because that's not an objective in Latin. If they use stick figures and staple it together, if the Latin's brilliant, then give it an A. If they do a leather-bound, beautiful, embossed thing and the Latin's horrible, it should not get a good grade. And so make sure that your rubric doesn't have points for creativity if creativity isn't one of the things that your class teaches. If they want to get creative with it, great, but that's not what you're teaching, and let them decide or not decide to do that. Okay, I've thrown a ton at you. Unfortunately, it's taken a little bit longer than I had thought, but do y'all have any questions? That is a great question. It takes a little bit of strong arming from our humanities department head to say, okay, let's work this out. One of the things that she'll do is say, you all need to go, here's the areas where you need to get on agreement and make recommendations to us as a whole department, what we're going to hold the standards, and then they have to go and propose it. And sometimes having that process of, I'm going to give you ownership to pull together and say, this is what the standards should be, that can get people more quickly on board. But it does take a bit of work. Developing the humanities and then also the math science handbooks that articulate those things has been a huge help in the last couple of years. You know what? I actually decided that I was getting too stuck on that as far as what it will actually accomplish. But let me describe it just a little bit, because I ended up not doing a slide on that. Our grades, if we do it correctly, actually can go back to, that. This is what will happen. Our parents will value and trust you. Our students will. There will be a predictability if we are grading well. Our students will have a proper understanding of themselves as related to their imperfection if we are doing this well. Our efforts will not be grading on trades and putting our identity with grades or being frustrated or uncertain about our grades. If we are all on the same page and we're consistent and things correspond.
Do you have anything in place for seventh graders who are coming out of that K-6 experience that's by and large more objective, and they come into contact with more subjective measures and they're not getting them like they used to prevent that developmental effect for our seventh graders?
Very good question. The question is, what do we do for seventh graders? They're moving from grammar into the logic stage as far as adjusting to not getting hundreds and everybody getting A's. Part of it is just parent and student education. It's saying, okay, put on your seatbelt. It's going to get a little harder. And here's what that means. It's talking with them, their homeroom teachers, their classroom teachers at the beginning of that year, and some of it actually at the end of the sixth grade. I'm not anymore. I used to be head of logic and rhetoric. Now our head of logic. He goes and meets with the sixth grade classes and says, here's what's coming, guys, and here's what you need to do to be prepared, so that they're just mentally get more focused and prepared for that. We give a student who does nothing in a discussion a 65, which it doesn't destroy. They still have it. If they talk the next week, they got a 70. if they engage, we kind of peg as reference points, not that it's the only grades that you would get in those subjectives, but 95, 85, 75, 65. There's movement in that, but just as a general reference, we're going to give you an A, B, C, or an F. And those numbers-wise, it'll relate to that. Sometimes it's A pluses and A minuses, but as a general reference. Which is a different way, and sometimes like, how can you give them 65 points? It didn't say anything. I'm giving them 0 points, because 69.9 and down is zero. Yeah. The question has to do with when we make post-test corrections, do those end up ever being bonus points or anything like that? We don't. We actually have a school policy where we don't give extra credit on anything. You can never get above 100. And so depending on the kind of situation, as far as what people got right or not, it gets a little creative. It requires judgment and discernment to figure out how should I handle this. And a lot of times they'll work up to a department head or myself. This is what I'm thinking. This is how I think I'll handle it, but I'm not quite sure. Yeah, the question was about really objective testing, multiple choice and true false. I don't have that problem because we actually don't have those tests. For us, even a objective knowledge, we're still asking them to write it out. And so if it's an identification, you're going to have to tell me who Constantine is, and you probably won't do so perfectly. Over the course of all the tests, will you answer all those perfectly? Sometimes they might. Again, it's not that it's not rare, but... through middle school, that's the case. I think in the grammar school, it's going to be a little bit different. I'd have to give that some thought since I haven't weighed into that. And I think part of it is, you know what, to the question earlier, there'll probably be more hundreds. I love devil's advocates.
But I expect their papers to show the level of training that they've been given in writing papers. So when I was listening to you talk about, you know, how it's a Latin book and we're not writing on their drawings, okay, I can get that illustration. But what that brings to my mind is, okay, we have science.
Okay, that's a good point. The question of, if I'm teaching science, does that mean I can't grade them if their grammar is really bad? And the answer is yes, you can. And we do the same thing. We expect the math papers and science papers they're graded. It becomes a question of how big of the target is it? How much are you going to make that a focus? Are there particular things on the grammar that you're zeroing in on? Are there significant problems that you haven't had a chance to review? I can talk a little bit more on this because I know that we've actually kind of run out of time. But yes, I would grade on the grammar. If there are significant issues that you should teach them, since a lot of them are having those issues, or this is stuff that every seventh grader should know and I need to hold you to that, then I would approach it that way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Remote at all to change slides or
I'm buying one.
Okay.